What's up, everybody? Welcome to Mixtapes. I'm your host, Eric Stanglin, and my next guest is a host of the amazing podcast, 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. He's also a senior staff writer at The Ringer and has a new book out called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. I'm hoping to find out what metal songs he finds appropriate to watch a car to. So glad to have him on the show today. Welcome, Mr. Rob Harvilla. How you doing today, sir?
Yo, dude, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me. The best metal song to wash a car to. You know, I think I do start with White Zombie. I think Thunderkiss 69. Is that the year? I hope that's the
65.
Year. That's 65. Sorry, I was close. It was within 4 years. That's a good, I would wash my car to White Zombie. Really, any White Zombie. That's, you know, but I'm open to suggestions.
I throw that in there for my guests because that is the first episode I listened to of your show, the Pantera Walk episode.
Oh, yes. One of the longest episodes I've ever done. And I still don't quite know how that is, but I got real enthusiastic about Pantera just out of nowhere. That was a very good time.
It was great. You had me hooked, man. Like just the way the episode was, how you didn't try to do any of the imitations voices and you said that in it. I was just like, amazing, man. Amazing.
Yikes.
You know,
you do not want me doing impressions of anybody, really.
Hey, let me ask you this. Do you remember your first music memory? Something that kind of cued you into like how music was going to be important in your life?
Man, that's a good question. What I return to often is the image that my parents have given me of me in our living room listening to the Cars, to the new wave band, the Cars. I love that album, and I would clutch. It was the vinyl. It was the record, right? And I would clutch the album cover, and I would just run around in circles in my living room when I was four, I guess, maybe even earlier. Then that's not so much a memory as just what my parents have implanted in me. You know, I'm trying to think memory wise, you know, I remember like early mid 80s radio, right? I was living in the suburbs of St. Louis, Missouri, you know, just with the radio on or with my dad, you know, listening to Meatloaf or Steve Miller, you know, with my mom probably listening to U2, you know, or pop radio like Janet Jackson, Michael Jackson. You know, it's just sort of a jumble of 80s ephemera, you know, mostly absorbed through the radio with a little bit through my parents' record collection and then a lot through MTV, you know. And so I don't know if there's one foundational song, you know, that starts this all. I'm sure there is. I just can't remember it. But I have a very sepia toned like 80s, you know, memory bank, you know, just a collage in my head of all that stuff jumbled together.
Me and you are about the same age. So MTV was kind of an important thing for us for sure. And
of course.
And radio was too. Radio was important also. For me, it was Eddie Van Halen when I was 9 years old. Ooh. watching the Jump video, and then it was over. I think right after that I told my mom, I'm like, hey, can I get a guitar? And she's like, no, all my friends did drugs and dropped out of high school. I'm like, Mom, I'm nine. I haven't even gotten to high school yet.
That's right. Yeah. And now you have five guitars sitting behind you. So I guess it all worked out. You went for the guitar, not the synthesizer after the Jump video. And that's a very good move on your part.
Yes,
you
know, yes.
Nothing against the keyboard on Jump, but you knew where the action was, even as a 9 year old.
Yeah, and there was no keytar in my future either. It was straight up guitar.
Yeah.
That was it.
I've never seen like a keytar. I've never been like within arm's length of a keytar in my life. It occurs to me now. I'm sure I've seen that in person, like at a show, but I there's probably an instance when I've been in the same room as a keytar, but that is almost entirely an MTV, like a TV phenomenon, that instrument.
I live in Casino World. I live in Reno. So
okay.
I've actually seen a guy play a keytar, just him and a keytar, but I've never been in a room other than that room with a keytar.
Solo keytar. That's elite.
It was
impressive.
Yeah, I didn't hang out long.
a little of that goes a long way, I suppose. There's a couple songs, you know, he does Jump and you're like, all right, I can.
I'm good, I'm out. Yeah, no. Okay. Talented guy, but not for me.
Sure.
So when did you pick up an instrument? Because I know from listening to the show, you know, you definitely had picked up an instrument. Did you pick one up pretty soon after that or no?
I did piano lessons as a kid, like a real little kid. I can remember having like the Casio keyboard with like the demo thing, you know, like a modest sound bank, you know, of like drums and backbeats and stuff. Like not one of the giant ones, but
Right.
yeah, probably from 5 years old, I took piano lessons a little bit. I played, you know, I started trying to play guitar mid high school, you know, just with like a Stratocaster, you know, knockoff of some capacity. I started playing bass right out of high school. You know, I played bass in a few bands in college. You know, played acoustic guitar, had like an open mic night phase in college as well. You know, and I, so like piano, guitar, and bass all to exceedingly modest degrees, you know, and a couple, you know, two, three, four bands. You know, that never achieved any renown, even locally, really, you know, and that was all unfortunately sort of done with by the end of college. You know,
Okay.
it's a bummer. Like I still have the guitar that I had, I still have the bass that I have. You know, I got a piano out here that mostly my kids play now. You know, it's a drag, really, you know, that I dropped it, you know, even if, you know, rock star, you know, fantasies were never actually in my future. You know, it was still a cool thing to do, even if I wasn't very good at it. And it's a drag, you know, that I've set it aside more or less at this point.
Well, maybe after the podcast, this is what gets you started up playing,
There we
picking up,
go.
banging out some chords again, right?
Free time. That's right. I'm gonna relearn how to play. What would I learn to play first? I used to play the Cars' Drive. That was pretty with a capo and the fourth fret. That was pretty good. That was probably my best open mic night song, if I'm being honest. So I'll start there and see where it goes. You know, maybe you'll see me on tour
See,
2
there you
years from
go.
now. There
Play
we go.
a little bit now before your book signings, right?
There we Yeah, I could do that thing. I could be
Hide
the guy at the bookstore who plays the ukulele, you know, and then reads a chapter. You know, we'll see. We'll see.
Hey, when did you get into writing? When did the writing bug grab you?
It's what I always wanted to do. It's so weird, but I want to say from when I was in like fourth or fifth grade, you know, I started gravitating toward writing, toward English, you know, and in high school, I applied to one college. You know, I was in Ohio by then, and I applied only to Ohio University because of the journalism program, right? It was like that was the best school in state. You know, Northwestern was nearby. That's prestigious, but it's out of state, a little more money. So I wanted to write for Rolling Stone, you know, and that was true starting when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. It's been a very weirdly, you know, focused career path. It's what I always wanted to do for some reason, you know, from the time that I was listening to the radio, the Cars, you know, my parents' record collection, MTV, like music was my focus. And then writing was clearly what I wanted to do for a job. And so it all just sort of followed. And I knew what I at least wanted to try to be, you know, pretty early on.
That's awesome. And you got there, you got to the finish line, which a lot of people can't say they do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been enormously fortunate, right? You know, and I think about all the papers that I've been at. You know, I got out of college in 2000. I started working for an alt weekly here in Columbus, then one in Oakland, California, then in New York City. You know, and so many of the places that I've worked for are gone now, you know, or are very much smaller versions
Yeah.
of their former selves, you know, and I just the industry collapsing around me, you know, and publications, you know, collapsing very soon after I leave them. There's just an enormous fortune that I've had, you know, to be able to do this at all from the onset, but to still be doing it 20 years later, 25 years later, almost at this point is wild, is amazing. It's very fortunate.
Yeah, the shift is wild when you do think about it, where everything, I remember being a kid and, reading, Circus and Spin and, Rolling Stone and Hit Parade or whatever I can get my hands on. I was more of a rock kid when I was first started growing up, and then
Seems like it, yeah.
I kind of expanded upon that. I think we all do. I feel like you listen to music differently than a lot of people, and I don't know if you've gotten that before. Maybe you have or not. It's kind of what drew, it's kind of drew me into your podcast, to be honest with you. My friend Metal Tony turned me on to the Stephen Perkins episode. He said, "You got to listen to this podcast." And he literally just pulled it up in the studio. He's like, "Listen now." And I listened to the first 3 minutes. I was like, "Oh my God, this is brilliant." And then, I listened to the Walk episode. Then I get a hold of my buddy Moots and I'm like, "Hey man, you would love this podcast." And it was just, you're sharing it. It's like a community thing. It's really cool. But, you paint a picture of music for the listener. So when I listen to your podcast, it does a couple things to me. Number one, it makes me want to kind of listen to whatever I'm hearing from you that I haven't checked out or re-listened to, right? You know, when I listened to Cornflake Girl, that episode, I was like, I got to listen to, I got to listen to Tiny Earthquakes again, a little Earthquakes again. I have to listen to it, right? The way that you make it personal, where you talk about your friends, you talk about being in the car, like, you know, obviously your writing is super important to it. How much do you think your journalism brain is responsible for that, the way you do listen to music, if you've even thought about that?
It's very, everyone needs a friend named Metal Tony, first of all. And then you, Moots, is that your other friend?
Yeah, it's my
friend. M-O-O-T-S? All right. It's very important to have friends named Metal Tony and Moots to share these things with and to be, have them shared with you in turn. This show, which I started in 2020, is different from anything I've ever done. You know, I was a rock critic, you know, in the classic album review mode. It's like, now I'm going to write, you know, about this Radiohead album for 800 words, you know, and it's very rock critic forward mindsets, you know, where it's very deeply, a lot of references, a lot of arcane rock critic language, you know, the taxonomy, you know, of the way you describe the guitars as angular and stuff. It just, it felt very insular the way I was doing it. And I wanted the show from the beginning to be a little different and to be a little more personal. You know, I didn't go into this show thinking I was going to talk about myself or my friends or my family or my, you know, my teenage years to any degree. It's not that I thought I was inherently interesting, but I just, in trying to cast a wider net and to get as many people potentially interested in this as possible, I think just talking about my past as a way of getting you to think about your own past. You know, it's not that my thoughts on Pantera are especially profound or my experiences of that music in the past, but it just makes you think about your own, you know, your own times driving around and what song you were listening to and, you know, what friends you had in the car and where you were going. Like, everyone has those base level, you know, like mundane, but still spectacular and very important to you experiences. And, you know, and I just talk about my own and they get you thinking about your own, whatever songs were involved in that. So I think the language and the approach of this show is very different to anything that I'd ever done previously, you know, and then you add in the podcast aspect, you know, the having to say everything out loud, you know, having to type everything out, but then speak it. You know, I think changed pretty radically the way that I talk and the way that I write, both on a sentence level and just in general. Like, it just became naturally more conversational, you know, more personal, you know, and less based on sort of a rock critic thing of like getting all these references and like you have to know the entire history of Lana Del Rey or whatever to understand what I'm saying in this album review. You know, it's just more personal. Like, I remember driving to, you know, Wendy's and this song was playing, like, this, just that kind of stuff seemed way more appropriate, both for a podcast about 90s music, you know, that had an inherent nostalgia element, and both for a podcast in general. You know, that my voice, it's so weird to me still to think about my voice in people's ears or in people's cars or whatever, and just the weird intimacy of that. And I think that that too changed, you know, my overall approach.
Now, that makes sense, because I listen to you the most when I'm taking a walk or taking a bike ride.
And there
it just,
we go.
Just kind of clears my head. And then it's like, then I can jump right into the song or whatever, you know, and kind of go further. But, you know, in the oh my God, Mazzy Star episode, you know, you talk about Low, and you always talk about a band before, for the most part, before you introduce the song, right? So when you talked about Low, just the way you talked about the singer holding a note for 7 seconds, or the things that you notice. For me, I notice things too. I'm a music teacher. I play guitar. I've been doing it forever, but I don't notice it the way you do. And you've got me thinking differently when I listen to music now. Things jump out of me more, like in that new Michael Jackson episode you just put out. It's like, I realized Michael Jackson screams a lot in his tunes, and I never realized that.
Yeah, right.
You know, little things like that. I think that's the gift that you give, where, you paint a picture for all of us and we remember what we like and whatnot, but I think you get people to listen to music a little differently, because I don't think people...
Well, that's a really cool idea. I really appreciate that. That's a very kind thing to say, and I appreciate it. You know, I do... I'm trying to come, you know, these are songs that people know pretty well for the most part, right? You know, like, everybody's heard Fade Into You.
Sure.
You know, everyone probably has like personal memories related to that song. And so trying to find a new approach to that, you know, I do just try and listen a little harder and listen on headphones and just listen to, you know, the tone of their voices, you know, and just little details. You know, I dig that stuff, and I think that that lends itself well to a podcast format. It lends itself well to a format where I can play, you know, like 8 to 10 second clips, you know, and point things out. You know, part of it is to play those clips, I have to sort of to use clips like this. Clips from popular songs in a podcast, I have to provide commentary, right? Like I that's the thing of fair use is like I'm adding something, I'm pointing something out. You know, that's, it's not really criticism in the this is good or bad sense. It's just an observation, you know? And I just think that that's another thing that the podcast format does particularly well, you know, but the Mazzy Star episode, I really enjoyed, you know, because I could talk about Lo, you know, and Mimi had just died very recently. And I'd been thinking about that band a lot, thinking about her a lot and sort of re-listening to it and just trying to find a way in and trying to find a connection. And sometimes it's tenuous, that connection, you know. Lo and Mazzy Star have a little bit of a similarity genre wise, if you sort of squint a little bit, but maybe they don't. Sometimes the connections that I make are entirely personal, you know, made up to me, but I'm trying to cast as wide a net as possible, but also to zero in as much as possible on, you know, moment to moment, you know, sounds and changes and tones of voice and things like this, just all in the purpose of finding a new way to look at and a new way to hear, you know, these songs that we've heard a billion times, whether it's Semi-Charmed Life, you know, whether it's Cornflake Girl, whatever it is, just finding a new approach to it, you know, puts me in the mind both of a macro sort of approach and a micro approach, I guess.
Now, it makes total sense, and it's done that for me, so thank you. So there's a lot of stuff that I listen to now way differently than I had before. You know, the 90s seems like it's one of the most interesting decades for music, in my opinion. Especially for me, like the early 90s, late 80s, to me seems like there were so many different bands coming out at that time, like your, you know, that were getting big, like your Jane's Addiction, your Primuses, you know, and they could go right along with your Guns N' Roses, and you know, there were so many bands that could coexist, and people seemed to really not be so gatekeeping at that time, if that makes sense. But what stopped you from doing, you know, 60 songs that explain the 80s because of your age? You know what I mean? Like, because the 80s was a, you know, I just watched that documentary on Netflix about We Are the World, which is like,
I gotta watch that.
It's such a time capsule, man.
I'm sure it is.
It's such a time capsule. But like, what made you decide the 90s, like compared to the 80s?
The 90s, it's interesting. When we decided, all right, we're going to do a podcast. We're going to do a podcast focused on songs. You know, every episode is going to be one song. What's the best format, sort of framework, like a decade? Like what decade? The 90s. You know, that all happened pretty quickly. And I think the glib way that I put it at the time was that the 90s was far enough away to be firmly in the past, but close enough still to feel present tense and to feel, you know, like 90s aesthetic. The 90s aesthetic is still with us, you know, and you can buy Nirvana t-shirts at Target, you know, and pop stars now, you know, Olivia Rodrigo, Billie Eilish, whatever, are playing around with 90s, you know, music, you know, whether that's pop punk, whether that's industrial, Nine Inch Nails kind of stuff. Like it's, the 90s felt influential. You know, I had this big spiel, but in the end, it's because I was a kid in the 90s. I was a teenager. You know, I went to high school and college in the 90s, you know, and my line this whole time has been like, the music that you loved when you were a teenager is the music that you're going to love most in your life ever. Right. And so the 80s, a lot of that applies as well, you know, and my memories of the 80s in a lot of cases are as vivid as of the 90s, you know. And it may happen, you know, we are ending the 90s. I got 3 episodes left. You know, we've tacked on a bunch of episodes a couple times, but it's time to just stop, right? We don't want to overdo it. And so I want to do something else. I am going to do something else. I don't know what that is yet, but certainly the 80s are a thought. The 2000s are a thought. You know, what is interesting about the 80s, and it breaks my heart to say this, is like, to hit that sweet spot for the 80s where it's people who are teenagers in the 80s,
right?
Like those people have to be late 40s, 50s now, right? You know, like it's, there's no question, you know, based on the feedback I receive, the people who reach out to me, you know, that the people most into this show are people about my age, you know, are people who are teenagers, sure, in the 90s. And so the 80s, you are de facto sort of aging up your likely core audience, you know, and that's an interesting prospect, you know. But of course, I, you know, there's so many songs right from 1989 that I wish I can do and I can't because they're not 90s. You know, I
Right.
talk all the time about Epic by Faith No More.
Yep.
You know, I talk all the time about The Cure, about Disintegration being in 1989. You know, De La Soul's 3 Feet High and Rising was 1989. You know, it's vexing to me sometimes, you know, the format, the strictness of the 90s framework. You know, there's songs just outside late 80s or very early 2000s that I'd love to hit, but the 90s really did suggest itself as a sweet spot, you know, both nostalgically and both for me personally. And so the 80s is absolutely an option. You know, I have no, you know, I'd love to do a Jump episode. You know, I'd love to do an episode on all those 89 songs I just mentioned. Like I could do the 80s very easily and it very well might happen.
You know, I don't think a lot of people understand like the TLC and the work that gets put into doing a podcast, especially like how you do your podcast. I have an idea because, you know, I'm a musician and I'm a fellow podcaster. Can you let the listeners know what it takes to put together a single episode of your show? Because you're not doing it by
Well,
yourself. You got to have an
I am
engineer.
not doing it. I am not doing it by myself. And it's, you know, from a structural standpoint, it's unquestionably, I am very fortunate to be at The Ringer, you know, and the Spotify, I think it already bought The Ringer. And so to have that additional layer of support is invaluable to me. But like I have a producer, right? And so my episodes are scripted, you know, down to the word. You know, and I'm playing all these clips. You know, there's like 50 song clips, each about 8 to 10 seconds. You know, and I'm pulling those clips myself off of YouTube, right? And so
Okay.
the script is everything I'm going to say, and then the clips, you know, with a YouTube timestamp marked. And so it's all there for the producer, but I have a producer who then goes and records it. You know, he sits on a Zoom call with me, and I read the script. You know, and I stumble, you know, like a half dozen times or so in the course of 8,000 words. 45 minutes, however long it takes. And so I have a lot of help, you know, both, you know, for my editor and producer, Justin Sales, from the beginning, sort of guiding this, you know, and editing every script and helping me pick songs and guests, you know. So I've had a producer editor from the beginning, and I've had a string of actual audio producers who are actually, you know, cleaning it up and putting all the clips in. You know, and that's been Jonathan Kerma, you know, for a year plus now, and he's been awesome. And so I have a great deal of help. You know, it's a laborious process, you know, from a writing perspective and getting all the clips together. And it's a lot, but there's no question I couldn't do this and never have had to do it myself.
When you're listening, because I'm assuming as you pick a song or you have help picking a song or whatnot, you listen to the song a couple times to get into the mood of what you're going to write about.
It's usually ideally, you know, sometimes I'm scrambling, you know, but ideally I can spend the vast majority of like a week or so, you know, listening to the song, but ideally their whole catalog, right? You know, and in some cases I don't have to do that. Like Nine Inch Nails Closer, right? Like that's not a song where I'm like, oh, I gotta go back and I don't remember what that one said. Like
Right.
it's just the downward spiral is so important to me as an angsty 16-year-old that it's just imprinted on my brain. And like that's one where I don't even know if I had to re-listen to it at all. You know, but there are plenty, you know, Pantera, to be totally honest with you, that was a case where like I was familiar, you know, I'd listened to those records before and I knew like the hits or whatever. I had
Sure.
some working knowledge of them, but not the sort of intimate, I listened to these guys constantly when I was 14 type situation that I had with a Pearl Jam or a Smashing Pumpkins or whoever. You know, and so that was a deep dive for me, you know, and sort of doing, like I say, it's sort of the focus, the hyper focus on what is an incredibly large body of work. If you include like the 80s records that they sort of semi disavow, but like, you know, going from, you know, starting with the 90s, you know, that's a daunting catalog on its own, Pantera's, you know, just three or four very dense, you know, very intense records where there's a lot to be found there. And I loved doing that. And so it starts with how familiar I am with this song, this artist, this genre, you know, and in some cases I'm learning about it really for the first time. In some cases, this is somebody I've been listening to practically all my life. at this point. And I like that mixture. I like going back and forth between things that I already know a lot about and things that I really don't know very much about at all, you know, and I get to learn finally.
And you do a great job of including people in the show, which I think is neat because it's not just the main character. Like if you're talking about Smashing Pumpkins, you're not just talking about Billy Corgan. You know, you
Right,
I
right.
tend to hear the bass player's name a lot in a lot of the, you know, a lot of the episodes, or you'll talk about past members. And I can tell you do your
Yeah.
homework a lot. You know, sometimes, like you said, you know it. If you have a favorite band, you know, or a couple favorite bands, you know, if you're that type-minded person, you know everybody in the band, when they left, what album they played on, all that stuff. But like you said, like in like Pantera, it's like, you know, who was the singer's name even before them, or the whole Trapper Keeper reference with that album cover? Like, you know, they
I
tried to
love that
hide that
album.
past so much that,
They
you know, you got
do.
to do your research, man, you know, which I appreciate too, because I think, like I said earlier in the podcast, I think it helps people want to go back and either discover or rediscover music. And I think that's a good gift you're giving people.
Well, that's awesome to hear. That's very, again, that's very kind of you to say. And yeah, I mean, that's the ideal is that the Pantera episode in its when it's done, when it's out, has appeal both to people who don't know very much about Pantera, but also people who do. You know, that I'm not just rehashing, you know, Wikipedia info or whatever that a
Right.
Pantera fan already has and doesn't need. Like I'm bringing some new insight to it, but also bringing in like new people and sort of being honest about where I fall on that spectrum. You know, I try not to misrepresent, you know, how much, you know, familiarity I had going into an episode, you know, with somebody. You know, I try and represent myself as discovering something along with them sometimes, like the Selena episode, for example. You know, like it's she is so important to people who lived that in real time, were huge fans of hers, and were so affected by her death. You know, and that's somebody who I knew from afar, you know, from an emotional distance, honestly,
Right.
compared to like a super fan, and just being honest about where I am starting out, and then trying to speak both to the super fans and to people who don't know much about her at all. Like that's sort of the magic trick of this, ideally, you know, is that I can speak to both camps regardless of which camp I personally start out in.
And I think you making it personal kind of is that connection between the two. I think, because, like, you know, you probably connected to, so being a guitar teacher, you're probably connected to so many kids trying to learn that one riff from, you know, Walk or whatever. And like, I could picture a bunch of kids like trying to do that, going, fuck this, I'm done playing guitar, or like that, you know, or that's the thing that makes them go, yeah, I want to kind of continue. You know what I mean? It's relatable. And it doesn't, I think which is cool with me is I listen to a lot of your episodes where maybe I don't listen if I don't get connected, because I'm like, oh, I don't care about that song or whatnot. But it's like the way that you approach the you approach every episode, I'm like, no, I want to listen to this episode because I wonder where he's going to start, and I wonder where it's going to go, if that makes sense, you know?
No, it does. I always like it when people say like I don't like this song at all, you know, or I don't care about this song at all, but I listened anyway and I'm glad that I did. You know, like the Macarena, for example. Like people have sort of a performative like, "Oh God, not the Macarena." You know, or like Achy Breaky Heart or stuff like that. Songs that aren't it's not that the songs are bad, it's that the song was so ubiquitous at the time that there was no way to not get sick of it and to feel like you stayed sick of it all your life. You know, it's just it was overplayed and beaten into the ground at the time, and you hold a grudge against that song forever. You know, being able to go back to that stuff, you know, and try and reclaim this song and its greatness and just the humanity of Billy Ray or Los Del Rio or whatever, like that's a cool challenge to me as well. And it's a cool thing to hear from people, you know, who weren't fans of this song, who didn't think they'd enjoy this particular episode, but they did, you know, because I found like a way to do it, you know, that can speak to somebody who's skeptical about the song going into it.
Are you hearing from artists that, because I know Courtney Love, yes, for sure, right? And I thought that was super cool. I mean,
It was
that
wild.
intrigued the hell out of me, to be honest with you.
Me
But are you
too.
hearing from other artists, I don't know, I don't want to call it hate mail or giving you props or something, but are you hearing from artists when they catch on that you've done an episode on one of their songs?
Courtney is by far the biggest, the most prominent example of that, right? You know, somebody passed her the whole episode and she was into it, and I was so relieved that she was. I'm trying to think. I've had a few cases where like somebody reached out and said like they passed it along to the Goo Goo Dolls manager and they're going to listen to it, or like somebody with the Cardigans. I said,
Oh.
I think, sorry, I like emailed me as like, hey, you know, I know people in the Cardigans and they heard it and they thought it was cool. Like, I just like sort of in passing emails, DMs in that sense. That's happened a couple times, but I can't really think of an example of somebody, you know, positively or negatively, you know, having a substantive sort of reaction. You know, I have been fortunate to talk to some artists, you know, current people, you know, who are making music, you know, and Open Mike Eagle, you know, the rapper, the dude from Eve Six, you know, I interviewed him a long time ago once he got big on Twitter, you know, and so I've talked to a few artists, but I prefer it that way. You know, it would make me pretty nervous, you know, to have, you know, the guy from Third Eye Blind, you know, on the horn, like yelling at me about, you know, everything I said about him, you know, in that episode. Like I'm at peace with not getting too much of that direct feedback. That is fine with me.
And I can totally see that. And I think it keeps you open to talk how you want to talk, which I think is cool. Talk to me a little bit about that Courtney Love experience, because, you know, she's really interesting. But I found that I don't want to put it any other way, right? But that interview was so cool because the things you're learning about Kurt and lyrics and you know, how I'm like, man, you're only going to get, and who knows if she's full of shit or not or whatnot, but you know, I don't think she kind of is it most of the time. So it's kind of a nice little peek through the window, you know, a little peek through the curtain to kind of understand that little time period. How did that conversation go for you? How'd you feel about it?
I mean, it was wild. You know, I was so grateful to her for doing it. You know, the timeline there is like, I do a whole episode. I do Doll Parts pretty early on. Somebody passes it to her. She listens to it. She reaches out to me. You know, we're talking a little bit, me and Courtney, and I'm thinking of doing the Nirvana episode, you know, and I feel like I want to warn her that I'm doing it. You know, like, just so you know, I might end up doing Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, sooner rather than later. And I think I had asked her if she wanted to be a guest and just gotten back like, I don't know, I don't really do podcasts or whatever. It's like, that's fine.
Right.
You know, I would not have been a billion years asked her to do the Nirvana episode. Like, that's so intense.
Sure.
It's so personal, you know, but she reached out to me about it. You know, she suggested it to me and I was really grateful for her time. And I mean, we talked. The interview is like an hour and 45 minutes. And I say like 200 words. Total, like and that's what you want. That's what anybody wants. People want to hear what Courtney Love has to say. And it is truly impressive and fascinating the way her mind works and the connections that she makes. And she's lived through so much and she knows so much and she's listened to so much and she's pulling things, you know, she's simultaneously on these tracks of like her personal memories and like the biographical sketches of the people around her and like these celebrity encounters that she's had and all the places she's lived and all the eras of her life, you know, and you're just along for the ride. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just sitting there and I sort of talk to her back and forth a little bit if she needs me, but she doesn't, you know, like you just want to hear her perspective. And I was so grateful to her for doing that. And I think by design, the result is not me interviewing her. It's just me listening to her along with everybody else. And that's what you want, you know? And I do think that her perspective, her way of seeing the world is so unique, you know, that there's nothing to do but just get out of the way and let her do it. And I was so grateful to her for doing that. And it's the most surreal moment of my career by far. You know, to be on a Zoom call with Courtney Love, you know, singing, you know, the alternate lyrics to Smells Like Teen Spirit that she's reading off, you know, Kurt's handwritten. Like, I can't process this. You know, I can't imagine myself as a 16-year-old, you know, like picturing myself in any kind of interaction with Courtney Love someday where this stuff is happening. Like, it's wild as hell. But it was a highlight of my career, unquestionably.
Yeah. And yeah, it is wild when you can look back on that and think, you know, you never would have thought that at that age. There's no way in hell. Like, and in the opportunities that you have, the people you get to interview, you know, it's definitely surreal. Let's talk about the book for a bit. I would be an awful podcast host if I did not promote your book. What made you want to write the book after doing the podcast?
You know, I from the beginning of my career, you know, from 2000, the year 2000, like I figured I wanted to write a book. You know, that's just what you do. You know, you write for papers, you write for magazines, and eventually you write a book. You know, it's just that was always the thing, the big, you know, climactic thing looming over the horizon. That would be the summation of my entire career, whatever bullshit, right? And then you get 20 years into your career and you're like, oh my God, like if I'm going to write a book, I have to actually write a book. Like it doesn't just, it's not just going to happen because I vaguely want it to happen, you know? And so this, the podcast, the scripts are written out, you know, word for word for word. And so I have them all, right? And so I have like literally, it is probably solid 750,000 words, you know, of raw material, you know, now on, you know, I have three episodes left. I've done 117 episodes of the show, you know, and like easily 750,000 words. It's like, it's insane.
Right.
And so my thought at the beginning, you know, that a book would be easy. I would just publish the transcripts, right? Like you just fire it off to a publisher, but like that book would be, you know, like car sized, you know. And so the question with the book, the challenge, which I grew, you know, which was daunting, but which I grew to embrace, was how to radically compress, you know, 750,000 words into normal book form, you know, like what does 10% of this raw material look like? You know, I take these 100-120 songs, you know, that don't really have anything to do with each other in a lot of cases, other than they came out in the 90s. Like, how do I put them together, you know, into chapters, get them interacting with each other, bouncing off each other, you know, the contrasts, you know, the consonances between them. It was a cool challenge to me, you know, and to come out with a book that works for people who know the show well and will recognize, you know, stuff that's been on the show in the book, you know, but in new forms. But also the book can also work for people who don't know me or the show at all, which is most people, right? You know, like it has its appeal, whether you're really familiar with the show or whether you don't know the show at all. All you really need to have an interest in is the songs themselves.
How's the book being received? You're really happy with the reception of it?
I am. You know, part of being at the Ringer / Spotify, the privilege of it is that I don't know stats, you know, and I know that I should, and I know that it's a huge privilege that I don't have to be, you know, obsessing over downloads, you know,
right,
traffic, whatever, you know, but it just, that stuff scares me so much that I'm totally happy to just be blissfully unaware. Like anecdotally, how I know that I'm really thrilled with the reaction are the DMs, the emails, everything, you know, like the feedback that I've gotten is so much more than anything that I've ever done. And by that token, I'm thrilled with the book as well. You know, it came out in November, you know, this is also a COVID project initially, you know, at the bottom of everything. You know, we started talking about it in summer 2020, you know, it launched in October 2020. That's when my daughter, my youngest, was born. You know, we're housebound.
Oh, wow.
You know, we're locked down and we right. remain locked down, you know, long after, you know, even post vaccine or whatever, you know, COVID is sort of the shadowy thing behind this whole thing, you know, that we've been pretty locked down here. It's a pretty insular, you know, taking care of ourselves, you know, just here in the Ohio suburbs, just being able to talk to people, you know, in any form, like the thought of the parasocial sort of relationship that podcasts can form. You know, in the conversations that I've had over DM or like just doing shows like this, this is all so new to me and so cool to me. And so the book is an extension of that. But, you know, I got to go out to L.A., do my first ever like live podcast thing with Yossi Salik of Bandsplain. And like I just to see people who seem to know the show and seem to be familiar with me, you know, it just tripped me out, you know, for it to be in the real world almost. And so the book, you know, to have a physical object, you know, to finally have this book that I've been thinking in the abstract about writing, you know, for 20 plus years. I mean, it's so thrilling to me, you know, and it's, again, I don't know stats, numbers, you know, total sales, things like that. You know, it's just, I would worry too much about that stuff if I was too fixate on it. And so I just try and keep as ignorant as possible, but like just the feedback that I've gotten from the show and the book both is overwhelming to me, and I'm so thrilled about it.
I think it's a great way to view it too. I think too many people get like too hung up on numbers and equating numbers to success, where in a way, obviously, right, you have to equate that in a way, but at the same time, if you're being true to your artwork and true to yourself and you're putting out content that you're happy with, I think that's just the win. And then everything that comes out of it after is kind of the icing on the cake. You know what I mean?
Of course, yeah. And I'm so fortunate to have worked in journalism for 20 plus years, given the state of journalism. Again, like all the papers that I've worked at that no longer exist, like all these layoffs of so many wonderful writers, podcasters, editors. It's good fortune. It's outrageous good fortune that I'm still able to do this at all. And so you're absolutely right that the win is just getting to do it, and getting to connect with people in any modest capacity. To make these connections, it's the coolest thing, and I've just been so fortunate.
Like music, and journalism, I mean, I think obviously we're connected, what do you think the future is to keep it alive? Because is it Substacks? Is it Patreons? Is it, I mean, are you, do you really become your own, like, do it yourself guy if you're an up and coming person that's into journalism? Like, how do you save it? Because I don't see us going back to print, just like I don't see
No.
us going back to like CD sales and record sales, even though there are sales, it doesn't go back to the way it used to be. It's like we almost opened up. It's like trying to put, that analogy, trying to put toothpaste back into the tube. Like, it just don't
Of
work.
course.
Like, what do you see anything that you would say could help it survive? Because to me, honest, good journalism, it's getting scary how much it's getting lost within clickbaits and all that other stuff.
No, it's terrifying, and I always feel such at a loss when like kids, like teenagers, college students who are graduating reach out and it's like, what do you recommend, for starting out, and I just my past, alternative weeklies, right? Like they were free, they were in bars or on street corners, you could swear it was awesome. They're gone. They're not go not all of them, but the vast majority are gone. That career path is gone. The Pitchfork thing hit me so hard. The combination of Pitchfork and Sports Illustrated, and Sports Illustrated had been happening for a while, but it's dismaying, and when these people reach out to me, young people, I just feel at a loss to say like, oh, you gotta build up your online following. You gotta be on Twitter. You gotta be on Substack, Patreon. Like that's sort of what I try to throw at them, but like I just feel so ill-equipped to talk honestly about like what it's actually like, and what you actually do from here. Like I try so hard always, even now, to not be a doomsayer in this sense, but like it's bleak. I worked at Deadspin, right? Like again, so fortunately, I worked at Deadspin right before like the Hulk Hogan thing happened. And the assholes fired everybody. And now Deadspin, is defector. They went and they started their own site. They own it. They're running it. They're not trying to turn it into a venture capital scheme. It's sustainable. They have this huge audience that loves them. They have subscriptions. They can make a living, doing what people love for them to do, And especially when Pitchfork shut down, everyone's thought was like, we need defector for music. Like that model seems to be the future, but Defector had the benefit of, Deadspin's 10 plus year career before that. Like these were all writers who were established, who were able to do whatever they wanted to do, with such a high profile platform for years and years. And like they can start their own business. They can bring in X number of subscribers, who pay $60 a year. That's hard to do. It's like the thing of like when Radiohead puts out an album for free. It's like, oh, Radiohead changed the business. Like Radiohead was on a major label for 10 years, like built up an audience. Like they benefited from the old way, and it's cool that they pointed a new path, but you have to have that foundation, that audience for like a Radiohead model or a Defector model to be sustainable. But it's hard. The number of publications at this point, that are genuinely healthy, that genuinely have any degree of independence. That's why Pitchfork's one of the most respected brands in journalism, certainly in music journalism. And even people who hated Pitchfork, performatively, like respected it. You hate it because it's important, and just to throw that brand away, to fold it into GQ or whatever the hell they're thinking of doing, it was so dismaying. And Sports Illustrated, working at the Ringer. I grew up, I subscribed for a while, but I wasn't a sports journalist, the way more than half of the Ringer is, but they're just as dismayed about the death of SI, and I don't, I again, it's, I hate to end, a conversation about that with, I have no idea. It looks bleak as hell, but like it does, you know? And so you just, you point at what seems to be the way forward, and that's defector, you know, but it's hard to get there, but there's got to be a way, you know, to get there. But it does seem like just getting people to invest in you, you know, whether it's you personally or your publication, you know, your crew of people who are respected, you know, it's you can't count on anybody, any corporation, you know, whether that's Condé Nast, you know, whether that's whoever bought Sports Illustrated, you know, it's just from a corporate mindset, you know, these places just get shut down, you know, heartlessly with no rhyme or reason or economic sense to it.
I appreciate you being honest about that too, because, you know, no, it's true though, because speaking from where you're speaking, you know, you had the opportunities that a lot of people don't have now. It's like when I talk to, you know, students and they're starting bands, I'm like, you don't understand. We used to play bars. We'd have a cover charge. We'd make our cover charge. We'd make CDs. We'd sell CDs. We had some revenue coming in. Like now everybody wants you to play for free. And like no one buys physical merch anymore unless you're a metal band, they'll buy t-shirts. Like if you're a singer-songwriter, have fun selling t-shirts. It's not going to happen. So it's like, where do you continue to keep pushing to do the things you need to? I really appreciate all your time today. You were super generous with your time. I'm really glad we got to connect.
No, thank you.
It was absolutely awesome. Before I let you go, anything else you want to plug?
No. It's you know, the book came out in November and I'm thrilled with it. It's I have a lot of anxiety about the show, the 90s ending, right? You know, like I need to take a break. You know, I'm getting burnt out, you know, and I think from a production standpoint, you know, we need to take a breather here. But I'm coming back later this year. I don't know what the show is yet. I don't know if the format will be, as you said, like the 80s is entirely possible. The 2000s, I don't know, you know, maybe something totally different. But unquestionably, I'm going to keep doing a podcast. You know, we're going to find some other way to do it. But I, you know, for now, it's the last three episodes of the show, you know, and I'm excited about taking a break, but also terrified about leaving this behind, you know, because this is the most gratifying professional thing I've ever done. And I'm so thrilled with it and the response to it. And I don't want to lose it or risk losing it. But I, for right now, you know, we just want to finish strong, you know, and I'm thrilled with the book and I hope people check it out. And I hope that, you know, this is evergreen, you know, in the parlance of our time, you know, in that it's people can pick up this show whenever they find it. And that's a really cool idea to me.
Oh yeah. It's 100% that way. I turned my singer onto it and just said, hey, you got to check this out. I did the same thing my friend did to me and sat her down. I'm like, listen to this. And I go, I know you're
going to thank you.
Yeah. I mean, word of mouth.
That means the world to me.
Word of mouth is one of those things I think we lost too much because we relied too much on social media. And when they kind of mess with the algorithms, it kind of, there went your, you know, social word of mouth, if that makes sense. So
that's right. You need Metal Tony. Metal Tony, was that it?
Metal Tony and Moots. You need your friends to pass it around, man.
Yep. All right. Absolutely.
So Rob,
thank you for doing that.
Absolutely, man. Thanks again for everything. I really appreciate your time, man.
Of course.
Have yourself.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Have yourself a great weekend.
You too.